Hello, and welcome to the Guidehouse Insights Plugged In podcast, where we go deep into emerging sustainability topics and how they might be all around you. This is episode 13 of Plugged In. This will be the most unlucky episode, and coincidentally the one where we might talk about natural disasters and losing your power the most. I'm Jake Foose, a research analyst on the Insights Transport team. My recent research has been about sustainability all around us, from tires to transit to new types of fuel. This month, we are speaking with Grace Zucker about her work on microgrids. Grace is a consultant on the Guidehouse Insights team, where she works on carbon capture, corporate sustainability, hydrogen electrolyzers, and pretty much everything else that we've ever covered on this podcast. Grace is a BA in economics and environmental science from Barnard College, and during her time there, she worked as an intern here at Guidehouse, as well as a researcher for the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. She was also a player on Columbia University's Women's Club water polo team. Welcome to Plugged In, Grace, and thank you for using the phrase March Microgrid Madness that ensured you got to be this month's guest.
Oh, thank you, Jake. I'm so excited to be here.
Finally, excited to have you finally on. To start, you're like different than a lot of past guests in that you were actually an environmental researcher before you started here at Guidehouse. Could you get a little bit into that and how you got into environmentalism?
Yeah, of course. I love this question. I got into environmentalism, funny enough, from an interest in astronomy, where I wanted to learn about what is out there in hopes of finding solutions to issues on Earth. But once I realized that there's plenty enough to do here, I switched gears and took advantage of arguably some of the best courses my college offered, ranging from climate and atmospheric sciences, geology, dinosaur class, volcanoes, and brownfields, they were all amazing.
And then how did you start doing soil sampling work when you were in college? I saw that in your bio.
Oh, yeah. I was super fortunate to cold message a researcher at Columbia's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory because I was interested in his research that largely focused on environmental health and specifically geochemistry. Really, I will give him so much credit. It truly empowered me to take on research and make my studies my own. And he also connected me to a program called Secondary School Field Research, where I mentored high school students across the boroughs in scientific research, specifically focusing on air pollution and lead contamination in New York City parks. And we would go around the city taking soil samples in tens of parks throughout the city and using an XRF machine to quantify all the elements throughout the samples. And then I then devolved from soil sampling to focusing on air pollution measured with low-cost monitors called Purple Air that collect real-time data on things like PM2.5. And I was lucky to be able to use that data to write my senior thesis.
Yeah, PM2.5 is a really big deal, and I think is like undersold a lot in environmentalism, where we focus so much on carbon emissions and not the other emissions and other things in the air.
Yeah, no, it's so fascinating, and it overlaps with nearly every discipline and work, and I'm really grateful that I was able to do so much research on it, and it's definitely been, I've tried to integrate it with my work at Guidehouse as well in the last few months.
Well, speaking of your work at Guidehouse, I yelled at you to get on here specifically for your work on remote microgrids because they're really interesting to me. For people listening who might not have listened to previous episodes where we've touched on them in passing, could you give us like a working definition of microgrids and what we're going to be looking at?
Yeah, of course. A microgrid is a combination of various local energy sources like solar panels or wind turbines acting like a single smart system. And this allows them to balance electricity use and generation, even operating independently from the main power grid if needed. They are extremely valuable for places that are hard to connect to the grid and prone to natural disasters that wipe out the grid as well.
Are there any other, like, specific use cases that they are used for?
Yeah, so some of the use cases for microgrids are for commercial and industrial use, communities, campus and institutional groups, stationary military bases, utility distribution, and also remote purposes.
Where are we seeing remote microgrids be used? Are these places in the United States that I haven't seen? Or are these like emerging economies?
Across all regions, there's a lack of access to reliable electricity and the absence of grid infrastructure for underserved communities living in rural areas that make a lot of driving behind the growth for remote microgrids. In terms of need for remote microgrids, Asia Pacific is leading in that market and Middle East and Africa is following. So in Asia Pacific, the market is set to grow at a CAGR of 15%, and in Middle East and Africa at a CAGR of 21.9% in terms of annual capacity additions forecasted out until 2032. And specifically in these regions, Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa are big markets based on existing electricity access lagging. There's also difficult topography for connecting the national grid and general lacking infrastructure that remote communities need.
Are there programs or grants or legal infrastructure in these areas to make these?
In these areas, there's actually a pretty good amount of government support in deploying these, as they have pretty ambitious goals of universal electricity access in their nations. And so that's really driving a lot of growth. The only issue with these government projects or government grants and subsidies is that they believe that there's only the upfront cost to deploying these microgrids, that then when it comes to actual long-term duration and viability, they haven't looked out far enough for planning out and having the capital to fund the maintenance and care for the microgrids. So they largely fall into disrepair in a lot of these places, sadly.
Are the expenses mostly in maintenance and upkeep, or is the expenses also in generation? Or I guess, what kind of generation sources are being used for these as well?
Yeah, a lot of these microgrids are using renewable energy resources, which is great. They're using solar panels and wind turbines for the power generation of these microgrids. Some are using diesel backup, but those are really difficult for remote regions, considering you have to deal with shipping costs of the diesel if it's not accessible there. But wind and solar can be pretty easily integrated into these power generation systems.
The only main cost is the maintenance and the upkeep. But the generation is pretty much already there in the upfront cost.
Yeah, it's definitely covered in the upfront cost. There is a big cost upfront.
Yeah, there
is a big cost upfront of, you know, the hardware and software that gets put into building these microgrids. And those are so valuable. But then there is the cost out into the long term of routine maintenance, because just like anything, things degrade and they need TLC.
Are there any cool like microgrid innovations that have been occurring? In my mind, I'm imagining just a solar panel attached to some wires that gets hooked up to houses that need it. But I'm sure it's much more interesting than that.
Yeah, there's a few really cool microgrid innovations going on. One is the integration of AI into microgrid management, where they're providing a chance for remote microgrids to really withstand and stay viable in the long term. So these new systems can predict energy demands and optimize power generation from various renewable sources, and even trade energy with the main grid for credits. And all of that is allowing the microgrids to be more effective and efficient and less likely to deteriorate. Also, there's blockchain developments for peer-to-peer or P2P energy trading, which makes microgrids a hyper-local energy marketplace. And the technology can be used for residents to buy and sell excess solar power from their homes. And this is really cool for making the system more community-oriented, as the community itself has stake in the microgrid, which can help prevent degradation. And last, there's also another interesting development where there's a microgrid as a service business model, which essentially treats microgrids like a utility service, where they build and manage microgrids for communities or businesses. So this helps to eliminate the upfront investment costs, which is a huge deterrent for a lot of remote off-grid communities.
You might not have an answer to this question, but the blockchain issue, considering how much power is typically used in blockchain applications, how does that work end up working out? Is it like a drag down on the efficiency of it?
It can be, but part of the blockchain business model that is really interesting is kind of garnering private interest in this that can then take some of the cost off of the community itself, where the company that's deploying this blockchain energy trading is, they're benefiting from it as well. And so they're contributing to managing the cost of it while also allowing for the community to be involved in this.
To dial us back, I guess I got onto a path here. I wanted to ask about Sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia as specific emerging markets and why those areas have such a need for these remote microgrids.
So in Sub-Saharan Africa, 53% of the region lives without access to electricity, where 79% of the continent's population lives. This is around 1.3 billion people, and 58% of the population in sub-Saharan Africa lives in rural areas. This number is steadily declining, but it still makes for a huge market for remote microgrids, especially in areas that have hard topography, to be creating really advanced infrastructure, as well for renewable sources that can power the microgrids. Hydro capacity in this region is expected to quadruple by 2050. So that's a huge market potential for clean energy being produced out of microgrids. In Southeast Asia, around 70% of the region lives in rural areas, and they are really good about general access to electricity, where I believe it's over 90% of households in the region have access to electricity. But there is a good amount of intervariability among countries themselves, especially since a lot of the countries in this region have islands. Specifically, Indonesia has a really vast geography with over 6,000 inhabited remote islands lacking access to reliable electricity. So there's a huge market just with Indonesia, as they have the highest electricity consumption in the region at 36% of the total amount.
And I guess that leads to the other way we talked about this, which was all of these islands are much more exposed to dangers from climate change. And we talked about natural disasters that also lead to this kind of investment and development.
Yeah, natural disasters are a really key driver for remote microgrids. And it usually happens a little bit too late that nations decide to invest in that. Puerto Rico is a great example of a place who post-natural disaster has really invested into building out their microgrid infrastructure for themselves. And they're definitely a great model for other places, especially with climate change. These island nations and coastal areas are going to be exposed to a lot more cyclone activity and hurricanes, and having grid stability for your citizens is never going to become invaluable. So microgrids are a really accessible way, both publicly and privately, to ensure that your citizens have access to energy.
Are these, I'm assuming, are the ones you were talking about, where they're microgrids that are, I guess, tied into the larger grid system, so that something happens to one small part, it doesn't bring down the entire system. It just keeps, everyone else can keep going, and people know exactly where to administer aid and fix the grids.
Mm-hmm.
Have there been any other examples of natural disaster issues? I know you mentioned Puerto Rico, but I'm sure that there are a lot of other interesting case studies and examples of this working.
I don't know off the top of my head of specific natural disasters that have called on microgrids as a solution to it, but it across every natural disaster, whether it's flooding, hurricanes, extreme heat, extreme cold. I mean, we saw what happened in Texas in 2020.
The freezing storm. I believe it was either late 2020, early 2021.
Yeah, with what happened in Texas in 2020, 2021, that was absolutely devastating. And even in places like the US that we have universal electricity access, it's still extremely relevant and valuable to have microgrid capacity, so that in times like that, especially with how big and wide the US is and all the differences between, you know, the regional energy providers and utilities, it's nice to know at whatever micro level that you have another electricity generation source to call on.
Were these typically deployed microgrids in remote areas, and now they're kind of seeing, with the issues of climate change, their use in other places? Or have microgrids always been around and just people may not be aware of them?
Yeah, for some places, there has been a lot more development in areas, you know, that were seen for needing access than like the US. Like, for example, India has the leading amount of planned microgrid projects in the world, and just by the sheer size and, you know, their income level. But sadly, you know, over time, a lot of these projects have fallen through, again, for like the previous point of, you know, lack of routine maintenance. But I think people have seen through the successes of a lot of these microgrids in areas like India, Southeast Asia, and Africa, that it can really work to support developed countries as well as developing.
I had a professor in my grad program who did a lot of work on like rural electrification in India.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the findings was it needs to keep going. If you're establishing these grids and just putting them out there and then forgetting about them, it's what's the point? If these grids are being deployed as a way of like actually bringing these remote and rural areas into the larger economy and, you know, society of these areas around it, it becomes a lot more valuable and actually useful.
Right. Yeah. I think that that's generally a note of sustainability, is that nothing stands in silo. Even in developing car batteries, you have to be thinking throughout the whole life cycle of it, that to be mining and, you know, causing environmental harm to get these materials out to hopefully be sustaining a more green economy, you have to be thinking of recycling capabilities and how that can work to support other infrastructure. And so I think microgrids also, even remote ones, can't stand in silo and be seen as, oh, that's only benefiting rural communities or, you know, more developing regions, because ultimately it's in the whole world's best interest to find ways to sustain and have long-term viable energy connection, which will help with every other project and every other potential disaster to come.
And that seems to mean, when you talked about the innovations and the cutting edge, it seemed like the movement was to not have these just be these siloed off things. It seemed like the work with AI and the work with the blockchain, it seemed that the goal was to integrate these into the larger systems as a way of a backup, a storage, to make sure that people knew there was going to be power no matter what would happen.
Yeah, no, definitely.
The quick black question I always like to ask, Grace, is being, we're these deep researchers. We love to look at so many things and get deep dives. And we always seem to find really weird or interesting or strange things that come up in the course of our research. So anything you'd like to share with the greater listening audience, Grace?
I definitely do. It's very weird and cool, but there is super cool research being done for microgrids, specifically for different power generation potential for microgrids, aside from just, you know, how we think solar and wind and hydro and things like that. But yeah, some interesting but really weird ones are seaweed, like giant kelp.
Okay.
Because it's able to decompose to create biogas that can then be used to power the microgrids. But there's also another even weirder one, which is urine, which can be turned into ammonia that can be used in fuel cells to power the microgrids. That one is super whack. I was not expecting to read up on that one, but I was completely fascinated because, I mean, I'd heard of wastewater being used also because they're investigating using it or turning it into hydrogen fuel for microgrids, but then seeing urine explicitly noted was very interesting. And I mean, I honestly, like, yeah, I'll tip my hat to that. I think we need to always be working at waste management. So if we can be powering these things with our own urine, why even look elsewhere?
Yeah, I would have hated to been the person who really discovered that and had to keep working on it all the time. But that is how we discovered the element phosphorus. So
yeah, no, I give so much credit to these people for being so genius and outside the box thinkers. I mean, you know, I don't know if this can be said, but LSD was harvested out of wheat, and accidentally the researcher, you know, started tripping on LSD from it. And it really takes a lot of creativity and putting yourself out there and not even knowing that you're putting yourself in dangerous places or uncomfortable places to find really cool innovations.
I think also about the scientist who discovered microwaves, as he was walking past a microwave emitter with a chocolate bar in his pocket and it started melting. And he was like, that's strange, weird. And I think back, we're like, so how long did he stand in front of a microwave? Just.
Yeah, no, it's so amazing how clever people are being. And I mean, that's what's so cool about being in this field of people, is that they're really looking for powerful solutions to the problems that, you know, a lot of people have a doomsday complex that we're too late already. But I think just seeing like the passion that people have is super empowering to go forward.
Yeah, I think it's super easy to just look at, I mean, like any sort of IPCC prediction, be like, okay, it's over, what are we doing? But there's so much work that's still being done and can still be done. We're like, you know, the urine example, for instance, where that one sounds a little weird, but I'm sure it's like incredibly useful and incredibly powerful and will be helpful in the coming future. And we just need to keep putting all of our effort into it.
Yeah, no, it's so amazing. I mean, I also just saw a study being done on coffee being infused as a, I think there's a study being done that coffee is being used to make the hydrogen electrolysis cycle a lot more efficient as like a catalyst in the system. There's also a study being done, I believe in Sweden, on they're actually able to divide the electrolysis process in the tiny cell to make it more stable, because a huge deterrent in hydrogen uptake is people's fear of it combusting and exploding. And I mean, hydrogen is way less dangerous an explosion than fossil fuels. Fossil fuels, they explode high and wide. Hydrogen is kind of like an internal blow. So, you know, it hurts a lot less people if something were to happen, and also is not as likely to happen as people think. But there's been a lot of research development into, actually refining the process of hydrogen electrolysis to make it even safer and less likely to combust.
That's also really fascinating, because I just went to a trucking conference, and one of the things they talked about was the actual hydrogen you need for a fuel cell needs to be so pure that it's almost been holding it back as a system, where it's like, it's cheap to get the hydrogen you can use for the hydrogen combustion engines, which still emit a lot of, you know, really harmful materials. But as we keep working on hydrogen electrolysis, it'd be really cool to see fuel cells come around and just a quiet truck rolling through only releasing water vapor.
Oh, I found it. Caffeine makes fuel cells more efficient and cuts cost of energy storage.
Oh, wow. Caffeine helps fuel cells and me.
Yeah. I know, I said humans and fuel cells are extremely similar. Also, coffee grounds in your plants will catalyze growth. So coffee grounds should never be wasted.
Yeah, coffee grounds are a huge boon to compost groups too. They love when they get coffee grounds in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a compost in my backyard, which is really fun. Yeah, I'm lucky to have a backyard in New York.
Yeah.
It's fun, because I do really always hate wasting all the stuff, because it's good for the earth. So why are we throwing it away just to be, you know, hydraulic pressed into mountains?
Thank you to Grace for joining us on the Guidehouse Insights Plugged In podcast. To learn more, Grace's work is available on the Guidehouse Insights webpage. To keep up to date with the podcast, please feel free to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and wherever you get your podcast. We look forward to you joining us to our next conversation in April. And thank you to Guidehouse for providing us this platform of discussion. Keep up to date on the larger Guidehouse Insights work on guidehouseinsights.com. Grace, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Jake. I'll catch you next week.